Welcome to Shifting Mindsets for Better Health, a podcast series produced by our partners at Central Michigan University with a grant from the Children's Foundation. COVID-19 has impacted the lives of millions. Sharing information among healthcare professionals is going to be key to saving lives and improving outcomes. This podcast series brings together healthcare professionals across disciplines to share insight into the far-reaching effects this pandemic has on children, caretakers, and medical care providers.
Students missed out on opportunities to build their skills, to practice, to be with peers, to socialize.
Things that they could do easily might not be as easy now.
This episode is the last year on academic learning and athletic participation. Primary, secondary, and college students lost a year or more of normal school operation to the pandemic. Students felt disruption to their school experiences, both academically and in athletic participation. Dr. Paula Lancaster is the Dean of the College of Education and Human Services at Central Michigan University. Dr. Lancaster begins with observations from K-12 students.
The implications that the pandemic has had on children's education, to some extent, is not fully known or understood. We'll have to take a look at the long-term outcomes that we see children experiencing as the years roll on. But for right now, we do know that they did miss out on opportunities to learn. Once the pandemic happened and we began to close schools and go to remote learning, virtual learning, we know that students missed out on opportunities to build their skills, to practice, to be with peers, to socialize, to discuss all those types of things. And those opportunities to be engaged in learning certainly have an impact. In particular, we know that math learning was affected by the pandemic, by the interruption of instruction. Literacy and reading also affected. And those effects were felt across grade levels. There's sufficient data to demonstrate those outcomes. And we also know that students who were already experiencing some barriers to learning, whatever those barriers might be, students who were already experiencing barriers to learning, those barriers were exacerbated by the pandemic. And so if you think about the gap that we sometimes call the achievement gap, could also be, probably should be referred to more as an opportunity gap. That opportunity gap broadened and grew over the course of the pandemic. So that's something else that we really need to pay close attention to, which is that outcomes that are already inequitably felt by students and families and communities have become even greater. The opportunity gap, it's just a different way of looking at outcomes that students experience. Because when we talk about achievement gap, we're often assuming that students achieve based on their efforts or their abilities. And the reality is that in many, many cases, what students are able to achieve is also a function, if not largely a function, of the opportunities that are there for them. That would be directly connected to the resources that are available. The amount of experiences that they can have both inside and outside of the classroom, for example, the ability and opportunity to apply what they're learning, even the access to updated texts and updated materials can make a big difference for students. So when I think about the outcome gaps that we see with a lot of our students, to me, it strikes me as much more of an opportunity gap, or that should be the first question that we ask. Did these children and youth have the same opportunities to experience high quality instruction, have the opportunities to apply what they're learning to real life and relevant situations, all sorts of things? Did they have the same ratio of student to teacher in their classroom? Did they have access to additional supports and additional help within the classroom? You know, those are questions that we should be asking ourselves. The question of whether or not children can make up this gap is a great one. And again, we still need to do plenty of research. We still need to keep watching. I do believe that absolutely they can make up the gap. And I would say that I think it's important when we have these conversations about learning loss, a couple of things are really important. One is to take a moment and commend the teachers and educational leaders, anybody really who was involved in providing some continuation of learning, should be commended for that work. It was certainly a heavy, heavy lift to make these types of things happen. But in many cases, it's important for us to realize that the loss could have been greater if not for the work that educators did throughout the pandemic. So given that we were able to do that kind of work, that teachers and building level and district level leaders were able to make those kinds of changes to even provide the support and services that they did, I think tells us that yes, absolutely, these gaps can be made back up again. You know, it's going to take some time, of course, but we can do this. And I think we have some really good recommendations. There was a panel across the state for what we should be implementing moving forward, including ensuring that children and youth, young people have access to one-on-one or small group tutoring and assistance throughout the course of the day as needed, that we ensure that all of us as educators, that we shore up our skills and knowledge in the particular areas that seem to have been most affected. So I'd go back again to mathematics instruction, numeracy, literacy instruction, those types of things, that we sort of redouble our efforts and maybe in some of those areas. And also, I think that it's important for us to consider the other aspects of teaching and learning that we're not talking about when we only talk about academics, that socialization is critically important, that re-engaging children and young people in coming to school, being at school, working with their peers, learning from each other and with each other is a really important part of an aspect of what they experience in education. So again, I'd go back to the recommendations of the panel that was assembled in Michigan, which emphasized the need for us to increase the number of counselors that are available for our students, increase the number of social workers, school psychologists, even nurses. We have gotten in the habit recently of not having nurses available for our students. And one of the things that I didn't really realize was an outcome of the pandemic was that many students were not receiving their vision and hearing screening, because they just did not have access to those services while we were providing virtual instruction. So I think we will certainly work hard to address the academic aspect of the disruption that COVID caused, but there are other aspects that are equally important for the just general health and welfare of our young people.
In March of 2020, we had to move our education system online. Dr. Lancaster explains how moving education online had benefits as well as challenges.
It's reasonable to understand that online instruction, virtual instruction, is better than no instruction at all. Again, I'd go back to what we have seen is that the loss or the disruption for students could have been even greater had we not been able to move to this online or virtual environment. And certainly, we're beginning to learn and have been learning really what makes for more effective online instruction. We still need to consider that learning requires engagement. Learning is not a passive activity, and so we have to make sure we're paying attention to the ways in which we engage students through online or virtual instruction, the continuing interspersing of questions, question and answers, opportunities for them to actively engage, moments where if we're providing synchronous instruction, moments for them to be able to talk to their peers or to talk to others about what they are learning are really, really important for them to stay cognitively engaged in this learning. I think that's one of the concerns about virtual or online instruction for a lot of students is that they need the support of their peers to stay more engaged. So we do have to focus on those aspects. And also the notion of just clarity of instruction is really important in an online or virtual modality. When you're in a classroom, the teacher uses a number of cues to indicate to students what's critically important information and what's less important information, and kind of what the hierarchy of that information is. And we have to think about how do we convey that information to students in that virtual setting when they don't have the cues of seeing it written on the whiteboard or just watching the verbal and nonverbal things that a teacher does. So those are the types of things that we also need to be really thoughtful about. I like to say technology is infinitely patient. So if you record something and provide it for students, they can go back to it over and over and over again. So the repetition, the opportunity to really enhance the power in repetition, is something to consider when we think about online and virtual instruction. It's very possible that for some students, this virtual modality is potentially as powerful, if not maybe a little bit more, than in a face-to-face coursework. But I think it's, for the most part, what we hear certainly at the college level and what we hear from young people is that they still prefer being in school, being with their peers, and learning from their teachers. The students that generally get the least benefit from online instruction are those that live in low-resourced communities. So if they don't have access to the technology, that would be the first sort of indicator that this is going to be problematic. So low-resourced communities where they don't have access necessarily to technology. Also, there's been some indication that students with disabilities, for example, may experience some additional barriers, because while we might think about and be very, very deliberate within a face-to-face classroom about the various accommodations that we can provide and modifications and how we engage students, we don't always know how to translate those approaches within a virtual environment. I think any student who might struggle with attendance as well as attention might experience greater barriers within a virtual or online environment.
Student athletes face challenges during the pandemic from both COVID-19 infections and from disruptions to the athletic season. Dr. Nasher Amaria is a primary care sports medicine physician, an assistant professor of family and sports medicine at CMU's College of Medicine, and the head team physician and medical director for CMU's Intercollegiate Athletics. Dr. Amaria sets the scene for college athletes at the beginning of the pandemic.
Overall, in the beginning, could young people tolerate this virus a little easier than obviously your older population with more chronic medical conditions? Yeah, obviously they would be tolerating it better. But does that mean they shouldn't be worried? No, absolutely not. Because again, I've seen this in just my collegiate athlete population present as asymptomatic, being completely fine, versus one case where I did a physical on somebody who was very healthy. No issues going on with that person. I did a healthy person physical for his entry physical exam. 2 days later, this person is on a COVID floor because of unrelenting fever and not being able to saturate his oxygen. And again, having shortness of breath and chest pain. I would say nobody should really be operating under the context of they'll do fine with it, or they're not going to end up in the hospital, or if I get it, I don't have to worry because I'm young and fit. That's a very dangerous mindset, and that's kind of playing Russian roulette with some things that are beyond your control. Again, nobody really knows how it's going to affect them. The best thing that anybody can do is to just take measures to not get it. That's the best thing you can do. And in regards to talking about what the pandemic has done for, at least in my world of collegiate sport, in March 2020, I was at our MAC conference basketball tournament in Cleveland, which was first, no fans were allowed. And then we got word on the first day we were there that the tournament was going to be canceled after 24 hours. And then what became even scarier was that now that NCAA national tournament was then canceled. That really gave people pause. It was a rude awakening to, hey, we don't know what we're dealing with here. And that time when you're on the road with your teams and you're thinking you're about to play a postseason tournament that you usually do in March, and then all of a sudden you get told to go home. And then you come back to your campus and the campus is even saying, okay, everybody, don't come back from spring break, stay home. That's when it really became, well, what do we do? And the first thing that I was hearing from a bunch of sports medicine staffs across the country was, we really got to watch out for our athletes' mental health now. It was reassuring to know that everybody had the same concerns that I did, which was the mental health part. We were hearing it from athletic training staffs. We were hearing it from team physician staffs that, hey, we're sending our athletes who normally would be in a season right now, in the spring season or in the winter sports season, we're sending them all home and we're telling them to stay home. And that's something that they've never had to deal with. Nobody's ever had to deal with stop, break the routine of your seasons that you always had in your life with your sport and now just stay home. And we can't tell you when to come out of your home. We can't tell you when to come back to your campus. We can't tell you when we're going to have you do team participation of things again. We got very concerned of our athletes' mental health, where their mental health would be. I was very happy to be a part of the sports medicine community, especially the collegiate and professional and even the secondary school team physicians really came together through our AMSSM membership, which is the American Medical Society of Sports Medicine, and our American Osteopathic Academy of Sports Medicine, AOASM. We were on multiple webinars in the evenings in April and March talking to each other, We were all trying to learn from each other. We were all trying to ask each other, what is your community doing? What is your school doing? Even as a conference in the MAC, the Mid-American Conference, the head team physicians were getting together and talking about, what is your school doing right now? How are you preparing? What does it look like, the plan to come back? This was a very collaborative time. It had to be a very collaborative time. We had to collaborate across the whole medical specialties, infectious disease specialists, to virologists, to epidemiologists, to primary care doctors, to sports medicine doctors, to internal medicine doctors, everybody. Everybody had to come together and learn from each other, work together to try to figure out. The main thing that we were being asked over and over is from our student athletes. That was the thing. When can we come back? From our coaches, when can we come back? From our university administration, when can we come back? Now we have tests available. How do we test? How many times do we test in a week? What is recommended? How it affected our student athletes is kind of the same way it affected most people, just overall, like communities and nationally and over the world. It was, what do you do when the routine of your life is broken and all you can tell people is stay home? We kind of got on a routine of having meetings as an athletic training sports medicine department a couple times a week, where then we also said, hey, check in with your teams at least weekly, if not more so than that. And a lot of the athletic trainers are checking in daily, if not more. Make sure that they know that we're still here for them. Make sure that they know that they can still access their team physicians if they need to, through the phone, through email, through Zoom, WebEx, whatever. We were starting virtual visits through the student health clinic. If they needed to meet me for any reason at all, they could do it through a student health virtual visit. And even our mental health resources here were there for them virtually as well. But I really think this was an area where the athletic training staffs for every college around the country, making sure that wherever their student athletes were, in whatever corner of the world they were checking in with them, and they were emailing them, they were hearing from them. I think that got us a lot of the way, as far as they knew that even though they might not be here, they weren't alone, they were around. And we knew how they were doing, and we were checking in with them and making sure that if they didn't need anything extensively, that we were getting that for them.
By spring 2021, college athletics were back to competition with strict COVID protocols. However, these protocols did not stop the athletes from coming in contact with the virus and suffering from COVID infections. Dr. Amaria describes the effects COVID-19 can have on an elite college athlete.
When I'm returning an athlete from COVID-19 infection, the thing that I tell them that they can expect is that they will act as though they are completely deconditioned. Not severely deconditioned, but they will notice that things that they could do easily might not be as easy now. Like, so the athletes think that, oh, okay, I was isolated for 10 days and that's why I'm deconditioned. No, 10 days of isolation is not what's doing it to you. It's actually the fact that you had this virus. That's what's doing it to you. They're used to being in the gym. They're used to being very active. Yeah, maybe the 10 days also didn't help them, but at the same time, it's the fact that they had this virus kind of knocked down their conditioning to a point where I tell them, like, look, if you thought you were in mid-season shape right now at the top of your conditioning, which is, should be mid-season shape, this might knock you back to what you're probably like after you've had an off-season kind of thing, where you feel like you have to get your wind back and you have to get your aerobic fitness up again. And that might last weeks, and in some cases even months, before their conditioning is back to a level that they're used to being an elite college athlete. That doesn't happen all the time, but it's been happening in the majority of cases, to be honest with you, where athletes who've had it, they'll say, man, I'm just not feeling like I'm back to my conditioning level that I was at. I feel like my energy level is low, or I feel like I can't catch my breath and I'm wondering if I have asthma. It's less likely a new diagnosis of asthma all of a sudden. It's actually now this deconditioning component that's existed because of COVID. Also, myocarditis is a possible consequence. It can be transient, it can be temporary, it can be permanent, but it's somewhere hovering between less than 1% or less than 2% of cases that people might have a transient myocarditis. It might show up temporarily, or it might be there. And that's the whole reason that we're very, very concerned about the athlete's heart when they return from COVID. So that's why we do an EKG. And that's why we've done troponin enzymes to make sure that is okay. And in some cases, it's good that at least at this level, at the Division I sports level, we have a cardiologist on our staff who also reviews these EKGs after somebody who has COVID. And we're able to see, has there been a change in their EKG from the baseline EKG that they had coming in here to the EKG they have now. And is there reason to do any further workup for that person's heart? Is there reason to do an echocardiogram? Is there reason to do a cardiac MRI? But now we just had updated cardiac guidelines even from our NCAA governing body passed on. And it kind of, again, gives us a criteria of when to do deeper testing to look for any kind of cardiac anomalies. The cardiac anomalies, again, are kept to a very low percent, but even a low percent, it still gives us warranted reason to even do an EKG or do cardiac enzymes when we were returning our athletes from COVID. So because of these post-COVID effects, that's why we are as diligent as we are with regards to working up the cardiac aspect of their health, working up the pulmonary aspect if we have to. And overall, just kind of going off of their symptoms, making sure that their symptoms have cleared, their appetite is good again, they're not feeling any kind of chills or fever, their energy level might take a little bit to come back, especially because of the deconditioning piece, but at least they can breathe well, they're not congested anymore. And again, the sense of taste and smell part of it is actually a part of that too, because that we've been seeing takes a little bit to come back from too. Some people recover that sense of taste and smell if they lose it. Some people recover it in a day, and other people recover it over the course of weeks.
The majority of people who test positive for COVID-19 will recover with no issues. Dr. Amaria explains what we know about the long-term effects of COVID-19 on the body.
I don't think we know too much long-term effects right now. And I think that's the main thing that people in my field are looking at is what is it going to look like 5 years from now for somebody who had COVID now? What is that person who had COVID now going to look like 10 years from now? We want to say that, oh, hey, they just had a virus, kind of like they had the flu, and everything should be good for them, right? We just don't know because this is so new. This is so novel. We just can't answer a lot of long-term questions on right now. So even like the vaccines that have come out, I've run into people who've said, let the vaccine be out for a year, and then I'll decide to get it. Or let me wait for FDA approval instead of the emergency approval to give it. And that's all well and good if you want to do that. Are you playing a little bit of a gambling risk? There you are. Because again, I have also heard from people who were in the hospital who said, I wish I would have gotten the vaccine sooner, or I wish I would have got it early instead of waiting. Right now, all of the long-term questions as far as what is going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, a lot of people are going to be very curious to that. We had mentioned the cardiac piece in the athletes. We talked about the myocarditis piece. If you had COVID, will you hopefully not have any kind of cardiac changes 10 years after you have COVID? We don't know that right now. Hopefully not. Hope for the best. And again, hope that it would affect you just like the flu would. And the flu would not hopefully do that as far as causing any long-term or cardiac changes. But again, this is such a unique thing that we are all still learning about every single day. It's just hard to answer those prognostic questions for the future in regards to the vaccine. Is this going to be like an annual flu shot? It might be. And if that's the case, people shouldn't get discouraged by it. And hopefully we'll get to the day where it's going to be just another health maintenance thing. Or it's going to be another one of those things that you see your doctor for your physical, and your doctor is going to mention, are you going to get your flu vaccine? Are you going to get your COVID vaccine? And hopefully that's where we'll get with it. Do we want it to go away completely to the point where we can have the virus eradicated and then also not have the need for the vaccine? Yeah, that'd be great. But right now it's looking like, hey, it's around. It's going to be around. It's going to be another virus that the physicians or any caretaker in the world is going to have to watch out for. Then if that's the case, then if we need to do an annual booster for it, then we add that to the list of annual boosters that we should be doing.
It is clear that we will be living with the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic for years to come, but the effects will not just be medical. Dr. Lancaster shares her thoughts on the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on the education system.
The pandemic has caused an incredible amount of stress for teachers, without a doubt. I do think we have to acknowledge that even before the pandemic, teachers in our country were being asked to do increasingly more, being responsible for increasingly more than providing instruction in the classroom and teaching students and focusing on their academic needs. We have, over the span of a couple decades, asked teachers to address many, many other aspects of development and health and well-being than we used to. That has caused teachers to take on that burden because they do feel a sense of responsibility for their students, but also to have that added stress in the classroom. So it was there prior to the pandemic, but the pandemic just really exacerbated it. Everything that teachers were asked to do during that time frame was on top of kind of their normal ways of doing their work. So you're still going to be teaching students, but now you're going to be teaching students and doing all of these other things. So despite the challenges that we've been experiencing as a result of the pandemic and even some of the challenges before, I do think there are reasons for us to be optimistic. I have never seen this many conversations happen or this level of collaboration across the education enterprise happen around the disparities that our students experience. It's gratifying to hear so many people say, while on the one hand, we're looking forward to things going back to some semblance of normal, we also fully recognize that there are some things that we should not go back to, that there are things that we need to change within our enterprise, within education more broadly. And there's so much focus on moving forward, but moving forward in a much more equitable, much more responsive way, really focusing on seeing students in their full humanity. And yes, we're focused on academics, and yes, we want our students to excel, but we also realize that they bring multitudes of strengths to the table, and we want to focus on those and help them build from that place of their interests and their strengths. So there's been a lot of conversation about how can we come back from the pandemic and build a system that's better, more equitable than it has been, and also how can we recognize students, bring them into the conversation in much bigger and much more meaningful ways than we have been, and develop partnerships across the entire enterprise. That's been a really gratifying thing, is that we see educators where we maybe did our work in separate spaces before, we see them coming together across the entire profession, across the entire enterprise. And that gives me great hope for the future. I also think that the science that is going to happen around the pandemic is going to teach us even more about how students learn and what teaching should look like. And so when I think about people who are coming into our profession now or coming into teacher education right now, I think that despite what you might hear in the news, this is an incredibly opportune time to come into teaching, because what we know about the teaching and learning cycle is just growing exponentially all the time. And all of that information is going to make us better constantly.
Thank you to Drs. Paula Lancaster and Nashara Maria for sharing their expertise on the lost year on academic learning and athletic participation. To find out about our other podcasts, go to med.cmich.edu/shiftingmindsets. The Shifting Mindsets for Better Health podcast series is a production of the College of the Arts and Media, the College of Medicine, and the Interdisciplinary Center for Community Health and Wellness at Central Michigan University. Executive producer and host is Dr. Heather Polinsky. Interview recording and editing by Mr. Michael Potter. Produced by Drs. Judy Blabia, Allison Arnold, and John Lowry. Funded by a grant from the Children's Foundation.